Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on the data networking industry where real engineers get together to talk nerdy. Yes, Packet Pushers is a place where security isn't just talked about, but delivered by engineers who actually know how to spell IT. Unlike the security people who hang out at security conferences and congratulate themselves on their mullet cuts, their ability to pick locks, and their new fandangled judo hold, we do real security. And it's not often we get to talk about it without having to kill you all. Excited? Of course you are. When real engineers get together to talk nerdy, we don't have to apologize for talking technical or for waving our hands at the virtual whiteboard or sucking in the hot air in the hot aisle and pretending that we know what all the technical discussion is about. Today's show is sponsored by Vectra Networks, and we are talking to you about their security products and telling you a little bit about the company, their strategy, and how they've got a unique take on delivering real-time security in the enterprise. But before I do, welcome Mr. Banks.
Mr. Banks is here, sir. Here I am. So Vectra, another sponsored show, and as I've been digging through the white papers, this is one of those that's actually got something different going on. So the presentation that we're going to hear today is going to discuss a product that is not like something you've heard before, and that is what grabbed my attention as I was diving into the white papers. So this is a good thing.
Yes. When we first started to talk about it, I went, oh, security, analytics, big data, I'm not sure where.
Right.
The cynic in me sort of woke up, you know, from not that he's ever very far away. But let's introduce our guest today. So first of all, I'd like to introduce Oliver. Oliver, tell the audience a little bit about yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Oliver Tabacoli. I'm CTO for Vectra Networks, which to me, kind of my job definition translates into bringing order to chaos.
CTO, the man who thinks hard thoughts and then gets somebody else to look after them. Also with us today is Mike Bannock. Mike, tell the audience who you are.
Mike Bannock. I run marketing for Vectra Networks and previously ran marketing at HP's networking business. And I worked with Oliver at Juniper Networks, where I ran enterprise marketing.
Outstanding. So you can actually spell, you know, networking and things like that.
Yes. And I do have a degree. I actually understand how some of this stuff works. And what I don't understand, I just imagine.
Very good.
Let's kick off the show and talk very quickly about what it is that Vectra does and how it does it. Oliver, take it away.
Sure. So I think we all are used to opening up, you know, our favorite website these days and seeing a report of the latest breach. I think the poster child certainly for the last big one has been Target for a while, but it's only a matter of time before that kind of gets overtaken by someone else. And I think what's pretty clear in looking at all these breaches is that, you know, hoping to stop everything at the perimeter via some defensive measures is obviously not working perfectly as a complete strategy. So, you know, I've heard people quip to me, you know, it's like we're going to try and stop things from getting in, and if they get in any way, then it's kind of game over. Well, that is turning out not to be a way to keep your high-paying job at some of these companies. So if you can't stop everything from getting in, if you start with that premise, you know, where do you go from there? Now, typically, there is the other end of the spectrum, which has to do with forensics, which is, you know, when the FBI calls you up and says, we found a trove of data of yours in this computer in Kazakhstan. Can you go back and try and figure out how it got there, right? Which is kind of what happened on the Target breach as well. And so we're basically trying to really carve out all the territory between the initial incursion, so the initial piece of malware or attack or something that gets inside your network, and the ultimate forensic side of things. And to do this all in, you know, near real time. And what that really translates then into is that we really are looking both at inside to outside traffic, what we kind of call northwest, as well as looking at lateral traffic. Actually, the inside to outside traffic is north-south. Mm. Lateral traffic is east-west. And to actually remember what we see. This is in contrast with a lot of the prevention products that, you know, really have what we refer to as perfect amnesia, that, you know, they make it their business not to remember. We try and remember and put together the narrative arc of how do the dots connect and following the bouncing ball and seeing that play out over a period of up to a small number of months, actually. And then last but not least, to actually present all of that information in ways that are understandable by mere mortals. So, you know, sitting in front of a screen, not getting inundated with data, but actually by stitching all of this stuff together and providing a kind of clear story of the progression of the attack, allowing somebody to actually look at it and understand it without requiring certification and training and that stuff.
So let me just try and recap that. So breach has happened. You can't really do much about it. You almost need to plan to be breached at some stage or another. And you can't prevent everything from getting in because you've got a firewall. You can't block everything. Something's got to get in and out. Otherwise, you're not being useful. So you've got to come up with a way of saying focus on the incursion and have some sort of forensic system coming before and after so that you know what's happened.
I would annotate that slightly by saying since remediation is actually expensive, you do want to still stop as much stuff from getting in as possible. But counting on that as your sole, you know, part of your strategy in terms of security is, you know, leads to, you know, 1 month, 2 month, 5 year breaches, right, that are in play without you ever knowing about them. And that's really what keeps people up at night.
You're not saying that perimeter defense is useless. You're saying you need something to augment the perimeter defense that eventually someone's going to get through. You're sitting inside the network, analyzing the traffic flowing through a data center, and then figuring out what attacks are ongoing and then tracking that information.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
So that's the core of the product. Let's talk about how we make that. So whereabouts in the market space does Vectra fill a gap? How do we get that coverage with the Vectra product?
Every customer that we talk to has security at this point in time. So they have firewalls, IPS, possibly they've recently deployed a sandbox. They have endpoint security like antivirus. But we definitely fill a gap. As we look at each one of those, those devices in some way have to let some traffic through. Firewalls are configured to let traffic through on, say, port 80 and port 443. Every application is going across those ports. So there's going to be a lot of false negatives that get through those devices. IPS is meant to look deeper into those flows. Not everybody has an IPS, but there's signatures for just, you know, thousands and thousands of signatures for all kinds of things that have been seen before to optimize for performance. People are going to manage which ones are in place for the highest priority risks and the best performance, but there's still stuff that's going to get through that are 0 days that they haven't seen before and stuff that just has the signature is not configured. And then they hope to catch kind of like whatever is getting through with the sandbox, detonating PDFs, executable files to try to figure out what's coming through from the web or through email that's going to possibly be that initial exploit. And the, you know, what we're finding is the fidelity of the sandbox environment, that virtual machine mimicking the endpoint, isn't always perfect, misses things. A lot of malware that's been hardened and armored. The attacker's gotten smart. He knows how the sandbox works, so he knows exactly what to do to detect that it's in one and just kind of sit there dormant.
I was talking to somebody the other day who was pointing out that the dark nets, you can now actually buy a service where you can take your malware, and there's companies now who run your malware through all of the known tools to detect whether your malware will be detected or not.
It's a perfect example. And then a lot of the limitations exist on the endpoint security. What that really means is that the network is, you know, which is your soft GUI interior, is left to a large extent unprotected by a lot of these targeted attacks that, you know, are going to be 0 days because they're not going to use the same command and control server or the same techniques that have been used in the past for some of these broader DDoS attacks or botnet attacks that we have seen. And that's the gap that we really target to fill, is to give people visibility into the unknown and protect them from that.
Which really implies that you're not doing a signature-based detection. You're doing something else to detect these kind of attacks. How does that work?
That's exactly right. We're not using signatures at all.
Yeah, I mean, the way I would describe what we do is really to look at, I mean, we capture samples like every other security companies, but we really look at, you know, very coarse-grained behavior, patterns of communication that are durable over very long periods of time. And we can go back, we have detectors that we've written that we can go back and test on malware that was deployed, you know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, and it works. So the trick is really not so much ignoring the samples that are out there around the botnets and pieces, but to actually write very kind of coarse-grained behavioral models and, again, correlate all of that behavior over time.
Okay, so you're using heuristics, basically, to analyze traffic patterns and go, that looks like bad behavior. I don't like that traffic flow that I'm seeing. Let's dig into that further. How do you, as you see behavior that's going on then, how do you determine that it is indeed bad? I'm kind of speculating there's got to be like a suspicion phase and then a confirmation phase or something.
Yeah, I think the way to think about it is combining heuristics with machine learning, right? So the heuristics are a means of reducing the amount of data that you're trying to basically look at, right? So unless it triggers, at least at some level, on the heuristic level, it may not be interesting, right? Because the trick in all of these systems is actually to very quickly decide, you know, what 99% of the traffic you don't have to look at and to really begin to focus in on the traffic that remains. So the heuristics are just a means of data reduction. The machine learning that we then layer on top of that really has to do with having some sense of what combinations of those heuristic triggers really are highly correlated with nefarious activity.
As I was digging through the white papers, I know that you have a way to kind of score these score the traffic that's going through, score the conversations that are suspicious, and you have a certainty level so that you can have some degree of confidence that this is or is not bad behavior.
I mean, the certainty level really ultimately derives from machine learning. If you imagine calculating and capturing these heuristics and then plotting them and plotting combinations of them, right? In the machine learning parlance, you have these things called raw curves that you can draw that tell you, how good your detection is, what your false positive rate is, and precisely kind of where to really focus on the dividing line. Now, we do that for every detection that we see, right? So for every kind of discrete behavior, and a discrete behavior might be an individual flow, it might be a collection of flows that occur in close proximity in time. So think of that as a detection. But then we also aggregate that up at a host level to each host. What are the collected set of behaviors this host has performed over the last day, over the last week, over the last month? And what does that really tell us about the state of that host?
It's baselining then to some degree for a specific host. You know what's normal and therefore can determine what's abnormal.
It cuts both ways. There is a degree of baselining because clearly every host and every network is unique in its own way. And there is value to knowing what is normal for that host. Contrast that with, the large number of samples, botnet samples that we can obviously put our hands on, that everybody can put their hands on, run tests. And the sets of behaviors that we typically see on the botnet side are relatively impervious to individual hosts within individual companies. In other words, if you're going to infect 100,000 or 1 million hosts with a particular strain of malware, it's going to behave pretty much the same everywhere you go. It's really combining that kind of knowledge that you have, the indelible markers in some sense of bad behavior, but then also recognizing that, tuning that to the particular knowledge we have about individual hosts gives us a higher degree of accuracy ultimately in making our judgments.
So you're not going to put this at the perimeter. You're recommending that we put this inside the network, detecting the east-west. So if someone's gotten through your firewall, you're going to do the heuristics pass internally to the network to say something's gotten through.
Yeah. I mean, I think as Mike referred to it, we're, trying to prevent, basically protect that soft, gooey interior. I'm always reminded of the Far Side cartoon. I think they called it the soft, chewy interior, but in the Far Side cartoon. Basically, how do you protect that? Ultimately, it means that what we don't focus on is really trying to catch the initial exploit.
Yeah.
You have the firewalls, IPSs, and sandboxes at the perimeter to try and keep those bad guys out. You should keep using those things, as Ethan pointed out earlier, right? We're not suggesting that you take away all your defensive measures and just rely on detection. But there's a law of diminishing returns that kicks in on the prevention side. Let's say you're 95% perfect. Now you're going to have to spend again as much as you spent to get to 95% to get to 97%. And then you're going to have to spend again as much as you've spent collectively to get to 98.5% and so on. So at a certain point, you have to kind of decide that you've kind of hit the law of diminishing returns. So we sit effectively generally behind the firewall. The perfect place that a lot of customers put us in is on a span or a tap port off of core aggregation switches.
Yeah.
With the idea basically being that we can see all the traffic from the hosts inside the campus environment to the internet, but we can also see all of the traffic from those hosts inside the campus environment to the data center.
If you're hanging off of that part of the network, though, that's a huge amount of data that you could potentially be analyzing. What sorts of data rates can you handle?
Generally, what we see at core aggregation in most campus environments, again, this depends on whether you go with very large companies. The medium-sized companies with, 1,000, 2,000 employees, typically core aggregation is a gig to 4 gigs. We can easily handle that. For larger companies, it's a much more distributed problem ultimately. And the way we try and handle that is to have actually multiple devices in different parts of their network to give them the necessary coverage. So typically, we handle up to, 5 to 7 gigs of traffic in our larger appliances. And that's actually given us, for the 30 or so customers that we have deployments at today, it's actually given us very good coverage.
So the other thing that's in the top of my mind, Oliver, is that you can either have a lot of your nodes collecting a lot of data. Like you said, the boxes today run at between 1 and 4 gigabits per second. And because you're doing a lot of big data crunching, you've got to pull all those packets out, run the intelligence engine across the top of that data set to try and look for stuff that actually is worth matching on. But the other way would be to put it in front of your key hosts. So if you wanted to get started, you could say, here's my critical stuff over here that I need to look at, and put your boxes, put the Vectra software where it matters to monitor the key things, and then, everything else.
Yeah, we sometimes see customers basically look at this kind of more from a risk perspective. And certainly, when you're trying to run a proof of concept, oftentimes you don't want to necessarily blanket the entire enterprise as part of your proof of concept. So what do? You pick a particular floor in a building, or you pick a particular building where you have certain risk profiles. And the risk profiles may be that you have, in that building, you may have carbon-based life forms with poor judgment. That could be one risk profile. You may have outsiders, contractors, consultants coming in. So, whatever you think that risk profile is, you kind of figure out where your petri dish is, and you plug in at a junction point. And again, for us, it's really, we can detect in the traffic streams that we see. So you can pretty much, as a network engineer, think about, okay, what is the, what is a junction point in my network that would actually provide me with coverage for the areas that I'm most concerned about? And you start that way.
And again, you said this is a span or a tap as opposed to an inline appliance.
Correct. And I think that also obviously makes it a lot easier to do a proof of concept. It's not this, this heartburn that customers would have about, do I have perfect HA capability to be in line, and is it going to take any service down? It's passively sitting on a span port and trying to divine truth and give you what I kind of call automated epiphanies out of the traffic that cross that junction.
It's trying to divine truth. I love that. That's awesome.
I was thinking of automated epiphanies. Is that like unicorns coming in on luck dragons with little angels going, whoa? I mean, one of the other things too is, of course, because the IPS is at the edge. So if you've got existing security policy associated around firewalls and IPS systems, and they have to be configured this way, and there's a lot of rigidity around those sorts of processes, you're not trying to change the way firewalls work. You're not trying to replace IPSs if you've got them. You're saying, go and put this box down on a tap or a span port somewhere down in the network, however you wish to do it, whether it's a span or a fiber optic tap or whatever it is, and then we'll start doing heuristics. Now, one of the key things that I learned from the white papers is you're not going to start blocking. You're an informational, you're telling us that something needs work. You're not going to block traffic for us.
Yeah, I think this is another dirty little secret about, you think about IPSs, right? We call them intrusion prevention systems, right? The early acronym for them, the early TLA for them used to be IDSs, intrusion detection systems. Mm. Now, you guys have been in plenty of networks. Let me ask you a simple question. And how many of them did you actually see IPSs run in blocking mode? I mean,
I actually can't remember the last time I saw an IPS in blocking mode.
If it is in blocking mode, it means the profile has been dumbed down so much, it's only going to be blocking very egregious and obvious sorts of problems that really can't be false positive. Because false positives, in my experience, have just been a chronic issue.
Yeah, so what that tells you is if a technology that was invented in 1999 that could, in theory, be active and in line is still 15 years later not running active and in line, maybe being active and in line is not the most important thing. Maybe what's more important is actually building enough trust with customers that you're getting the detections right, to your point around the false positives. And ultimately, my other kind of view on this side is that you're going to actually have to watch a number of different things in order to have a high confidence that the sequence of detections that you've seen really tell you that the host is infected. And so this idea that you're going to see a single flow and you're going to actually block it gives you very little data and very little time, because latency then is also an issue, right? If you're in line and you're in blocking mode, now you have 5 milliseconds to make up your mind to do these things. So it actually becomes almost an intractable problem to do that with high accuracy and to block it and to do it with as little signal as you're consuming. And so I think we fundamentally believe that where we need to go at this stage is really to provide the context and the story. So beyond anything that you can block on the first try, provide the context, provide the story, let the customer decide based on the clarity of the story that you provide and the narrative that you provide, exactly whether they believe you, first of all, which is the first thing, and then what action they want to take. Now, that doesn't mean that a year, 2 years down the road, we won't have functionality in the product that allow you to automatically, from our console, quarantine a host or do something like that. But I think ultimately, nobody tends to put these kinds of complex security solutions in line and assume that they're going to be perfect.
Yeah, you're making the case that there's data is the key. And if you provide people with the right data, then they can go ahead and work on whatever the mitigation is going to be. And the trick then is analyzing enough data so that you actually know what the heck you're talking about, and you're properly informed before you move ahead.
It's two things. It's really analyzing the data so you come to the right conclusions, but then also aggregating it and telling it in a way. So again, if you go back to the Target breach, right, you'll read things in Bloomberg News and other publications that say, well, you know, the sandbox solution that they had fired a detection, you know, and they ignored it. Okay, let's actually look at that day inside of Target and think about how many detections that they had. Okay, maybe they had 1,200 detections. Well, yes, but this was a prioritized detection. It was high priority, right? We've all looked at IPSs. We've looked at sandbox solutions. The granularity is, you know, a third of the detections are high, a third are medium, a third of them are low. This is not a pyramid shape, right? So now you're basically saying, okay, I had 400 that day that were high priority. So the ability to actually reduce that down and to say, okay, on that host that had this high priority alert, what other things happened before? What other things happened after? What is really the sequence? And can I actually aggregate that down rather than saying here are 400 detections? Can I say here are effectively two hosts that you should go look at? And so the data reduction that you get by actually doing what a SIM does, what a security information and event management system does, which is to look at these things over time and then present them kind of together, is what we try and do in real time without kind of the overhead of, you know, deploying a SIM and, you know, tying humans to it.
I just want to ask you how your product actually is delivered. Do we go and buy an appliance? Do we buy some software? Is it a virtual appliance? How is it packaged? This very quickly.
We sell you a platform, and that comes today in the form of a physical device. It's just there, so it makes it a lot easier for somebody to deploy. This will actually be something you can deploy as a virtual machine as well. So, but our early deployments have all been a physical platform. And there's two of them. There's a smaller one with 4 gigabit Ethernet capture ports and a larger one with the same 4 gigabit Ethernet capture ports plus another 2 10-gigabit capture ports.
Okay, so today it comes as a piece of hardware. You start with that, but that's mostly because that's what customers are asking you for, but you see it as a virtual appliance in the long term.
That's right. As the virtual version, it'll allow people to put it into a larger number of places and collect data and provide a greater visibility into the attack surface around the crown jewels that they're trying to protect.
Yeah, that makes sense. I just wanted to ask that question because I'm sort of at this point, I'm going, now, if I wanted to put it in my network, how would I do it? Okay, so how quickly does it take to get one set up and running? So I've picked a box. I've got one of your hardware boxes. Does it take long to get one up and installed?
It's so easy, even I can do it. and it takes less than 15 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
You know, unlike the experience a lot of people have with you know, sophisticated firewalls or IPSs, there's no rule configurations to manage. There's no signatures to manage. You simply give us an IP address, and you can actually stop there. You know, I'm looking at the config screen right now for one of our production devices deployed, and after that, there's you can just leave all the factory defaults in there. The config screen is, you know, half a page. It's, you know, give us maybe an alias so you can find us. Tell us your DNS servers, otherwise we'll default to a public one. Tell us your network time protocol, otherwise we'll default to public ones. Tell us your SMTP server and who you want us to email alerts to and set those thresholds. Do you want us to write the syslog? Tell us that. You know, stop, you're done.
All the usual things. You need a time server, a DNS, and then it works. So really it's just give it an IP address and it'll start working. So it's not interruptive if you're using SPAN or TAPS. It's just a case of plugging it in and going. And okay, that makes sense. So not a whole lot of pain to get one going once you've got the wherewithal to get it, you know, once you've gone through the purchasing process.
I think the one thing that we always end up having kind of fun time with network engineers at customer locations is kind of playing the game of, do you really know your network, right? So they'll plug us into a particular SPAN port, and we'll make, you know, great claims about what traffic we shall see, right? And then we kind of look at it and go, well, no, we're not seeing that traffic. And then you go, oh, I guess our network isn't actually the way I thought it was, right? And so there's oftentimes a little bit of back and forth in terms of getting the network engineering right for getting the traffic onto the SPAN port.
Isn't it great that networking is so brilliant that we actually didn't need to know that stuff, but it works anyway? I mean, I have a saying, which is that I think heaven would be, for a network engineer, would be knowing that your network works the way you think it does.
On larger networks, if you're deploying several Vectra appliances, do they all communicate together? Is there an umbrella manager so you can look at an aggregation of data coming from them, or are they each independent?
They are today each independent. They will soon be, you know, have a hive mentality, or the Borg, depending on how you want to think about it. So the idea ultimately is that, you know, what we're working on is to both having them communicate with each other and share information with each other. So effectively all of the appliances that are deployed at a given customer location act together. And the, you know, what we refer to a single pane of glass, which, depending on how you like to spell it, you know, I've seen it spelled P-A-I-N or P-A-N-E. Yeah. We're shooting for the latter. So the single pane of glass is coming as well in Q3.
Good deal.
A couple of quick things. Let's have a quick chat about system architecture. We've got a presentation that we're going to give away with the podcast blog post. So if you go over to the Packet Pushers website and search for the blog post that goes with this podcast, you'll be able to download a PDF file. But Oliver, why don't you have a quick go at talking about the system architecture very quickly and explain to people how, you know, the system goes together?
Mike pointed out my prior experience was at Juniper, and so, you know, I'm used to kind of building systems that take packets off the network and then effectively consume them and make something useful out of them. So this system is at its top end not much different. Packets come in, let's say they come in from the top in your kind of mental diagram. They go into a flow engine. They're constructed into flows just like in every stateful firewall or IPS would have. And then what we basically do is we do protocol parsing and metadata extraction. And the goal here is to be, you know, highly opportunistic. It's impractical to basically at very high rates decode every protocol to the maximum level. So we know specifically what kinds of things we're looking for. We have a sense of what features in machine learning parlance are correlated with poor behavior and are likely to be indicators of nefarious activity. And we really extract those out and pipe that metadata then, the information about the sessions and the metadata, into a layer of algorithms. And the algorithms basically fall into multiple different categories. We have, you know, a collection of them that really tackle the command and control or CNC problem. We have some that really look at what I call botnet activity or botnet monetization. Think about spam, but think about spam not as you being the receiver of spam, but you actually hosting a infected host that is generating spam. So we're basically looking at all of the botnet behaviors like spam and DOS and Bitcoin mining and ad clicks from the perspective of the attacker that is in your midst, as opposed to from the perspective of the victim. So detecting all of those, that set of algorithms really kind of fall into the botnet activity tranche. And then the ones that are really most important to our customers are the ones that are really part of their targeted attacks on their infrastructure. So there you have any kind of reconnaissance that occurs as a result of an infected host actually now exerting itself laterally in the east-west axis, trying to find things that it doesn't know where they are. Any kind of attempts to steal information, whether that information be credentials, whether that information be data that host typically does not access, and then ultimately any manner of exfiltration, particularly stealthy forms of exfiltration using things like, you know, HTTP tunnels or other kinds of things that you tend to not look for on the outbound side.
You've got sort of like a classification. So if you see a HTTPS session and it looks like a tunnel, you're going to start to look at that more aggressively because that's an exfiltration method.
Correct.
And you triggered cascading levels of density as that happens. Is that simplistically?
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And then at the layer above that, so you have all these algorithms, right? At the layer that then receives all of the signals that come, these highly concentrated signals, right, that now come to the layer above that will basically tell you which host this behavior is associated with, how we want to score that particular behavior, and then how we want to score the host on the basis of that new behavior now being accumulated to that host. And so then the UI reporting sits above that. Obviously, we have the usual laundry list of you can integrate via syslog, via email, via REST APIs. But we've also obviously invested significantly in building a very good UI to actually give you the story then above that.
Oh, yeah, that was actually a good point I was going to say. That's not something we can ask on a podcast, but the user interface for this to get the visibility to my brain. You know, it has to come in through my eyes. It has to be visual enough to get me, tell me what I need to know.
Yes, and you know, we decided early on to make user experience, the euphemistically user experience, you know, the central thesis of the company. You know, I've worked at plenty of companies previously where, you know you're in trouble when the product manager says, next release, the only thing we're going to work on is user experience. You know, the subtext to that is it's really screwed up and the product is almost unusable, right? And so, you know, we started on the premise that if you don't screw it up, you don't actually have to have those releases where you're fixing user experience. And so we are exceedingly diligent on looking at the user interface. And the bar that we actually set for ourselves is that an InfoSec person who's never seen our product but actually knows InfoSec reasonably well can sit in front of our console and be productive in 5 minutes. There is no manual. We have committed never to hire a tech writer. So this is the high wire act that we're trying to perform, right? Yeah. So no safety nets. The thing better be intuitive enough to be understandable by that person who walks off the street and looks at it and goes, oh, okay, I get it.
Okay, that makes good sense to me. So, I mean, talking about usability sort of leads us into the discussion about a day in the life of what a networking security guy is going to look like with Vectra.
You know, what Oliver was describing doesn't make the product very easy to use. Matter of fact, we've had customers go on record as saying, you know, the thing is a very sophisticated platform, but it's, you know, it's a consumer grade experience. So one of the things that we've done is to take all of that information that Oliver described that we collect and all the detections that we have, and we correlate that into the behavior of an individual host. So rather than presenting somebody a user interface with thousands of alerts, the example of 1,200, and then you have to parse through maybe the 400 priority ones, you know, if there's several hundred alerts associated with one host, we actually represent that as one dot on a plot. And that plot has an X and Y axis where one of them is the level of threat and the other one is the level of our certainty based on the behaviors that we've observed. And one of the things that we've actually blogged about some real life experiences with customers, and one of them was looking at a network where, you know, kind of detections dropped off on a host on a weekend. They came back in, plugged their laptop in after returning to work from a holiday, and, you know, detections started going again for command and control behavior. And then what we started observing in the real-time detections were that the device started performing a brute force attack on another host, demonstrating that it was trying to expand laterally. And that allowed the security person to go and look at the specific device and realize, okay, this is a laptop that's been used outside of work. It, you know, they use it to go to a given site. It's been infected, and now they can remediate. But one of the more exciting events that we had fairly recently was we had a customer that was getting ready to trial the product. They were trialing it in two locations. They had it up and running in one, but they hadn't gotten it running in another location. And they'd gotten the dreaded phone call from a search engine saying, we're blacklisting you because you're attacking us. So they put out the call saying, help, you know, we have all these devices, but none of them are telling us anything, at least not anything meaningful. we sent our system engineer on site, and, you know, they gave us a spam port. We got ourselves up and running in a few brief minutes. And within 15 minutes, we had detected a number of hosts that were infected that were the ones that, you know, the guilty party is attacking the search engine, and they were able to quarantine those devices and essentially call off the dogs. But, you know, it's because the data about all this activity was presented in such a pinpoint finite manner that they were able to take action so quickly. So that just gives you a sense of, you know, what's a day in the life of somebody who's looking at this interface is presenting things in such a simple, intuitive manner.
So a couple of things that I want to just explore here is I'm thinking about an entire infrastructure in terms of what we've got, right? We've got the firewalls and the IPSs. We've already talked about them as being sort of staying the way they are, doing what they're doing because they are very valuable in their own way. And then we touched on the fact that, you know, when I talked about malware, we said that antivirus engines and endpoint defense engines don't capture everything anymore. And, you know, there's some high profile comments like Symantec says that their effectiveness is rapidly reducing. So how does Vectra replace or change the way security tools? What vendors, if you've got such and such a vendor in your network, what does Vectra compete against or what does it augment in your network?
I think typically where we end up is that customers look at us as an augmentation. Now, oftentimes, depending on the customer, we have customers who have a lot of perimeter defenses in place already and they just kind of put us in the advanced threat detection bucket, and that's kind of where Gartner in some senses places us as well. It's kind of this rough category of all the different ways in which you can try and find advanced stuff, and whether it's preventive or you know, detection, or whether it's payload oriented or network oriented or endpoint oriented. But for us, it really fundamentally comes down to, does the customer believe that their perimeter is already pretty good or not? And if it's already pretty good, if it's not good enough, like if it's, you know, 30% porous, they're going to spend some more to make their perimeter good. And then ultimately the question is, post the initial incursion, what do you have? So you really literally only have something like us, or you have the SIM. And I think, again, on the SIM side, we find that large customers, very large customers are, you know, capable of really getting value out of SIMs because they actually tie a fair number of human capital to it. So, you know, individuals who sit and understand the business and understand the network and understand the applications and write rules and, you know, get all of those things working. The vast majority of customers, however, that deploy SIMs have unfortunately become, you know, are underinvested in terms of that human capital. And so they end up just becoming a compliance check item. Yes, we have a SIM, you know, so we're okay from a compliance perspective, or unfortunately, a forensics item after the fact, even though they're not technically forensics. The reason people tend to use them for forensics is that they tend to capture a lot of data and keep it for a long time. And so you can typically reconstruct the past as a result of it. But I always liken that a little bit to, I don't know whether you know the, you know, find Waldo in the picture, right? And it's like you capture all this data, you step back a half a mile and squint, and you try and see what you can kind of find a particular pattern.
But the challenge I've had with SIEMs is that they're so complicated to use that even when, you know, the day I do actually have to go and look in the SIEM, it's been 3 months since I last used it. And I have to go digging around and get them, work out how to work it again, and then it probably needs an upgrade because it's a security appliance, and if it needs patches, it won't work until the patches have been fitted, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. You spend weeks, and then you suddenly find the SIEM's not capturing the data at the right place.
Correct. And I think fundamentally what that points out, again, is I think SIEMs are good when you literally have three people whose full-time job it is to nurture them, right?
Yeah.
But practically speaking, you know, you think about the vast majority of companies that we work at, other than, you know, the top tier financials that have, you know, a dedicated team to do that, it's truly impractical to think about how you solve that problem, you know, on a slightly more modest budget and more modest headcount. And so I think in the case of Target, again, the SIM just became a forensic tool. It became a way for, you know, after they got the call from the FBI, for them to basically reconstruct approximately when the initial incursion occurred. And that's always the dirty little secret about big data. Big data sits there begging you to ask it the right question, but you don't know what the question is. It's a little bit like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right?
That's right.
I mean, you know the answer eventually, right? And then you can maybe construct the right question to be able to get at it. But in terms of actually finding unknown stuff, it's not very useful. And so we flipped the problem really on its head by saying, rather than remembering everything in some misguided hope that you will come up with the right question a year from now, based on the data that you're collecting today, why not be much more thoughtful about what you collect? Collect all the stuff that you think has a high likelihood of being interesting, and then stitch that stuff together. And what that allows you to do is to, again, you know, automate those epiphanies on the one hand, but it also means that you actually don't need, you know, 10 petabytes of storage in order to actually remember the things that you're remembering, because you're not remembering everything. You're just remembering the interesting bits.
Okay, so I think we've pretty much covered the Vectra product from end to end. Now, I'll be frank here and say that when I heard about Vectra, I sort of went big data, security, analytics, and that is kind of a whole movement. But once through the process of learning about this product through the working through the sponsored podcast process that we go through with the vendors, I'm actually much more interested in the product. So if you're in the audience and you want to find out more about the information, Mike, tell them the people where they can go to get a closer look at Vectra Networks.
Well, of course, you can go to www.vectranetworks.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Vectra Networks, actually at Vectra _ Networks. One of the things that we have for people as a download today is a cyber attack detection report. It is actually a composite view of across a number of real deployments that we have, giving some people insight into what kind of automated epiphanies do we provide. And also, for those that are interested in getting a closer hands-on look, we have an opportunity to register for one of 20 free custom cyber risk assessments, where we'll actually bring a platform on site. We'll actually plug it into the right location to get the right traffic and give you insights into what could possibly be evading your perimeter defenses and in your environment, and help you find the right way to remediate that.
Fantastic. Thanks, Mike. Ethan, thoughts, opinions?
So what I said to you in the back channel was I love the ideas that are behind this this product. So my complaint about security for a long time has been, you can set up all the firewall rules you want. They're only going to be so smart and so capable. And then they're kind of, well, you just don't know what's getting through. You open ports. And even if it's a UTM box, or even if it's a, you know, more of an app level inspection, there's still stuff that manages to get through the door. And so getting to the point where we assume, yes, there is something that's made it in, what do I do about it now? This tool fits right in there, because there wasn't an answer to this before. In addition, there wasn't something that could handle a lot of data flowing through a data center, let's say, and have it be able to be analyzed in a meaningful way. You'd have overruns, you exceed the capacity of the device, it couldn't really deal with it, and it didn't take a whole lot of megabits per second to make that happen. So there's a product that slots in there, analyzes the data that's worth analyzing, that's interesting, and then gives you useful information about it in a way that doesn't rely on signatures. And signatures have always bothered me, because it seems like such a finite resource set. Okay, we know about these things, but we don't really know about all the other stuff.
I already know about what I know about. That's what I've got a firewall and an IPS for, right? And that's what they do. But that's part of an overall security strategy, right? It's not just about, you still got to have a firewall to block most things and have a control point that's monitor, you know, there's the rules. That's the rules there, right? And then you still got to have an IPS to do obvious detection. This is obviously bad. Just shut it down at the edge.
But then Vectra is filling in that gap beyond those things. So yeah, once the that wall has been breached, the perimeter has been breached, then now what? And we have an answer to now what. And I like that very much.
Well, I think that's just about it for the show this week. Thanks very much, Mike and Oliver, for coming on to sponsor today's show on the Packet Pushers. And if you're in the audience, please do go to vectranetworks.com and take a look at the product. And if you do get in contact with them through the show, please tell them that you heard about it on the Packet Pushers, because that tells them that what they're doing here with us actually works. So, Oliver, tell the audience what you're going to be up to for the next week. Say, you know, where are you going to be? Are you going to be anywhere exciting, or are you going to be heads down making things happen?
Yeah, my excitement revolves around heads down, making things happen. Again, I think it's my full-time job to bring order to chaos, and right now there's enough chaos to keep me busy.
Outstanding. Mr. Bannick, what about you?
Well, I'm getting ready for a number of in-person customer events we've got coming up, so I've got some presentations to prepare, and unfortunately that involves getting on a couple planes to places like Boston and New York.
Yeah. Not a bad life, but not a great one. Sometimes the flights aren't so great. Well, thank you. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show. So send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net. Leave comments on today's show, or if you want to have a discussion in the comments, please do so. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter as at Packet Pushers. We're on LinkedIn, Facebook, all those great things. Mr. Bank, your week ahead, anything exciting?
So by the time this gets published, I will have returned from a week-plus jaunt across the White Mountains of New Hampshire, which is my vacation this summer. I'm just going for a long walk across the mountains, going hut-to-hut in the Appalachian Mountain Club hut system, and looking forward to that. That is my week ahead. And if I'm tweeting, I'll tweet about it at EC Banks, and if I'm blogging, I'll blog about it at ethancbanks.com.
Fantastic. And I am going to San Francisco next week, so by the time you hear this show, I will have returned from a week in San Francisco at StructureConf and doing some on-site work with companies. You can find me rabbiting on my blog at etherealmind.com, or on the Twitter as at etherealmind. And please do join in with the community. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.